Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have another extra special guest. Andrew Slimmons has pretty much done everything on the wealth management side of the business, starting at Brown Brothers Harriman before going on to Morgan Stanley, where he started out as a client-facing wealth manager before moving into portfolio manager and eventually creating the Applied Equity Advisors team that uses a combination of quantitative and fundamental and behavioral thinking to create portfolios and funds that are sturdy and can survive any sort of change in investor sentiment. They look at geography, they look at cap size, they look at style, and they look at sector, and try and keep a portfolio leaning towards what's working best. These tend to be concentrated portfolios. The U.S. versions are 30 to 60 holdings, where the overseas versions are just 20 holdings. I found this conversation to be fascinating. There are a few people in asset management that have seen the world of investing from both the client's perspective and a client-facing advisor side to a PM and then a broader asset manager than Andrew has. He really comes with a wealth of knowledge. He's been with Morgan Stanley since 1991. That sort of tenure at a single firm is increasingly rare these days. I found this discussion to be absolutely fascinating, and I think you will also. With no further ado, Morgan Stanley's Andrew Slimmons.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. So let's start at the beginning with your background. You get a BA from the University of Pennsylvania and an MBA from University of Chicago. Was finance always the plan?
I think being in a competitive industry was all the plan. I played tennis competitively in juniors and went on and played in college. And I always liked the, you know, you either won or lost. And what I always liked about this industry, it was all about, you know, did you win or lose? There wasn't a lot of gray area. And I think that's what I do love about the stock market and investing in general, because there's a scorecard. And you can't, there's no room on the scorecard for the editorials.
No points for style or form.
Exactly.
It's just, did you win or lose?
Exactly.
So where did you begin? What was your first role within the industry?
Sure. So, well, my first role was opening the mail at a brokerage firm in Hartford, Connecticut. But I started my career at Brown Brothers Harriman right here in New York in a training program, which was great because they had commercial banking, they had capital markets, and they had the investment management side of the business. And that's what getting exposure to all those led me to believe, gee, I really am interested in the stock market and how it works and investing in general.
So what led you to Morgan Stanley? How'd you find your way to MS?
I was a research analyst at Brown Brothers, and I was covering, you know, in healthcare stocks. I realized that there must be something more to investing than just what was going on at the company level. Because I noticed that the things that were moving my stocks on a day-to-day basis weren't just what was going on at the company level. And University of Chicago, where I got my MBA, was obviously very focused on more the quantitative areas of investing. And I took FAM and French and so forth, and Miller and all those that taught me that what drives a stock price is more than just the company level. And so that was really how it rounded my knowledge of kind of investing, the first steps. And then coming out of business school, it was 91 and it was a recession. And I had met my wife in business school, and she got a job at Kidder Peabody, if you remember that, mm-hmm, investment mm-hmm. banking in Chicago. And I couldn't find kind of a buy-side opportunity. And Morgan Stanley had a department called Prior Wealth Management that covered wealthy individuals and small institutions in Chicago. And I needed a job, and I had a lot of student debt. So I said, hey, as opposed to going the traditional buy-side route, I'll start in this area covering clients and investing for them.
So 91, kind of a mild recession.
Mm-hmm, mild.
And really halfway through what was a rampaging bull market, what was it like in the 1990s in New York in finance?
Well, I mean, the thing that was amazing is we would have clients in the late 90s that would come to us and they'd say, Andrew, I'm not greedy. I just want 15, 20% returns a year.
Right.
And no risk.
With limited risk.
With limited
risk.
Right,
I knew you were going to go there.
And that is what is so fascinating about today.
Yeah.
Is today people say to me, Andrew, why would I invest in equities when I can get 5% in the money market? And what a difference in a mindset, which tells you where we are. In the late 90s, we had just gone through a roaring bull market. Optimism was just so rampant. And the worst year in the business I can remember was 1999, because as an investor covering clients, I was caught between doing the right thing for them, which was avoid these ridiculously priced stocks,
right,
or get on the train because the money is pouring through. And then it all came to an end in 2000, 2001, and I took a step back and said, thank God I never, I just didn't buy in the way some people did, and therefore saved people a lot of money. It was a tremendously good learning experience for me to stay true to your values of investing. Ultimately, they work out.
You are identifying something that I'm so fascinated by. The problem we run into with surveys or even the risk tolerance questionnaires is all you find out is, hey, what has the market done for the past 6 months? If the market's been good, hey, I want more risk. I'm more than comfortable with it. And if the market got shellacked, no, I can't suffer any more drawdowns. It's just pure psychology.
And I would go one step further. You know this, you're in the business, but when you first meet someone, you never know the ones that are going to be truly risk averse or truly can withstand the volatility and ones that can't. Some people say, don't worry, I'm not worried about the drawdowns. And the minute it happens, they're on the phone to you. And some people, I told you I wasn't worried and I didn't call you.
Right.
And you can never know just the first time you meet people who that's going to be.
It's a challenge figuring out who people really are. Not easy. So you start at Morgan Stanley in 1991. You're in that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
You start on the private wealth side. What led you to becoming a portfolio manager with Morgan Stanley Wealth Strategy?
So if you think about my career, I learned to be a fundamental analyst. I went to University of Chicago and learned that, there's quantitative factors that drive a stock price beyond kind of what's going on at the company level. The third part of my experience was being in private wealth management. Clients want to believe they all buy low and sell high, but Barry, you know that isn't the case.
Somebody does accidentally. Someone randomly top ticks and bottom ticks the market, but nobody does that consistently.
Exactly. And here's a great example of what I mean. If you think about the years 2020 mm-hmm. and 2021, growth stocks took off, right? But in 2022, they got crushed. Do you think more money went into growth managers and funds in 2021 or the end of 2022 after they got crushed?
The flows are always a year behind where
exactly.
the market is,
so,
right?
So what
people are backwards looking.
Well, and that's because there's something called the tear sheet. If you were my client, I went to you and said, Barry, I think you should invest in emerging markets because look how terribly it's done the last 5 years. And I hand you the tear sheet. You're going to
everybody
go, no
hates
way.
It. Right.
Hate it. So the problem with this business is a stock price does not care what happened in the past. Mm-hmm. It only cares about what's happened in the future. But as humans, we all suffer from recency bias. So what I observed in the 90s, it's a long-winded answer to your question, is
no, it's an
what
really
I observed in the 90s as a coverage offer, you can't get clients to actually buy what's out of favor.
Right.
And the flaw in the whole growth, value, U.S., international, is people frame, oh, maybe I should buy more growth because it's working. Well, except it gets too expensive. So the reason I left being in wealth management, I was convinced that I could start strategies using more quantitative, but give us flexibility. So if we could start core strategies, so that if growth got too expensive, we could tilt away from growth, or if Europe wasn't working, we could tilt away from Europe. That gave us more flexibility as an active manager versus saying, I'm only a growth manager, and then I'm always trying to justify why you should buy growth, or if I'm a value manager, always justifying why I buy value. Remember, by 1999, a half of value managers had gone out of business in the last 3 years, just before they took off.
That's unbelievable. I know folks who run short hedge funds, and they say they could always tell when we're due for a major correction because that's when all of their redemptions and outflows hit a crescendo.
And so that's the problem with the dedicated style, is you're always fighting human behavior just at the juncture with which you should be investing. They're selling their stocks.
So let me ask you the flip side of the question. If you can't get people, or if it's really challenging to make people comfortable with buying out of favor styles or companies, can you get them to sell the companies that are in favor and have had, you know, an exorbitant run-up and a really pricey, or is that just the other side of the same coin?
It's the other side of the same coin, but I think what complicates is taxes.
Sure.
Because people don't want to sell for taxes. And General Electric was a very important experience in my life back in the 90s, which was it became the number one stock. Everyone loved it, and then, you know, it went through a can't grow as quickly anymore. So the issue that I see in the industry is stocks never survive as the number one company, and so eventually they decline, and people don't want to take money off the table when they're the number one or tops because they have big gains. And then ultimately people sold a lot of General Electric with a lot less of a gain. So the trick is to reduce the exposures over time. So if I'm a core manager and I know that growth is expensive relative to its history versus value, we'll tilt the portfolio, but we won't go all into value, mm-hmm. all into growth, because timing these things is very, very tricky.
So you've been with Morgan Stanley since 1991, 3 decades with the same firm. Pretty rare these days. What makes the firm so special? What's kept you there for all this time?
Well, you have to remember that when I started in 1991, wealth management was a relatively small part of the firm. And I give James Gorman tremendous credit. He really grew that area because of the stability of the cash flow. I'm a pretty stable cash flow. And then when I progressed to Morgan Stanley Investment Management, it was the same concept, which was we value the multiple on stable cash flows is higher than on capital markets flows. And so I've kind of followed the progression of how Morgan Stanley's changed, and that's been a great opportunity. And then I look and say, well, I was able to go from wealth management into the asset management because the firm grew in that era. So it's been a tremendously great firm to be with, but my career has changed over time as the firm's changed over time.
Sure, I had John Mack on about a year ago, and he described that exact same thing, the appeal of wealth management. And part of the reason, what was it, Dean Witter, the big acquisition mm-hmm. that was done, was, hey, this allows us to suffer the ups and downs in the other side of the business, which has potential for great rewards, but no stability,
right,
versus ready, steady, moderate gains from the wealth management
side. We bought Smith Barney, so on
that
the wealth
was another
management.
Big
so
one,
then
right.
Over the asset management side, there's Eaton Vance, E-Trade Wealth Management, and with Eaton Vance came Parametric and Calvert. So the firm has grown in the areas that I've grown personally. So it's been a great, great marriage for a long time.
So your experience with General Electric, I had a similar experience with EMC and with Cisco, late 90s, trying to get people to recognize, hey, this has been a fantastic run, but the growth engine isn't there. The trend has been broken. Don't be afraid to ring the bell. And I'm not an active trader. I'm a long-term holder. Getting people to sell their winners is not
very
easy to do.
Very hard. But also, when stocks get very, very big, companies get very, very big, it just gets tougher to grow. In my experience, and this has nothing to do with GE, just in general, is when companies get big, usually the government starts looking into their business because they might dominate too much. And so it's a combination of why over time, and I know this is hard to believe given the last couple of years, why the equal weighted S&P does actually outperform the cap weighted S&P, because companies, mid-cap companies that are moving up, it's easier to grow.
What has it been, 25 years since the Microsoft antitrust?
That's
amazing. How often are equal weight S&P outperforming
it outperforms weighted? About half the time. It certainly had, I mean, think about last year. And through October, the cap weighted had outperformed the equal weighted by 1,100 base points.
Wow, that's a
lot. But the thing that's fascinating about this, Barry, and again, you know this, is that it's always the first year off a bear market low, investors sell. So retail flows were negative from the low of October 22 until for a year.
And that's until November 23.
Exactly. But if you go back to 2020, March of 2020, flows were negative until February of 21. So it always takes about a year.
February of 20, that's amazing, because from the lows in March, it was a huge set of gains.
Net flows from mutual funds, ETFs, were net. They're always negative the first year because of that rear view mirror recency bias. The reason why that's relevant, Barry, is because when investors finally said, I shouldn't sell anymore, I should buy, they're not going to buy what's already worked. They're looking for other things. And that's when the equal weighted really started out for.
Really interesting.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
So let's talk a little bit about your concept of applied investing. What does that mean? What does applied investing involve?
Okay, so there's the theoretical story about it, and then there's the practical story. I'm sure you'll get a kick out of the practical. But the theoretical is that I don't believe that a stock price return comes purely from what's going on fundamentally. You have to decide, should I own growth, value, large cap, mid cap, U.S. versus non-U.S. Any stock's return, about two-thirds of return in any one year, can be defined by those. So we have to get that right first. And that's the quantitative side. So we use factor models to say, hey, should we own growth stocks or value stocks? And so we tilt our portfolios quantitatively based on which of those factors is sending a signal that they'll work in the future.
So let me just make sure I understand this. Geography, size, sector, and style are the four metrics you're looking at and trying to tilt into what you expect to be working and away from.
Exactly. And the goal of that is to keep people in the game. Flip side is, you know, things are out of favor. They can stay out of favor. The problem in this business is styles of investing can stay out of favor longer than the client's patience duration.
Just look at value in the 2010s. I mean, if you were not leaning into growth, you were left way behind.
Exactly. And what I observed from my time being an advisor is at the end of the day, clients don't really care whether they own growth or value. They don't care whether they own European, US. They want to make money. And they don't want them to go backwards. And if all you keep saying is, yes, but you know, my value manager has outperformed the value index, and they're like, yeah, but the S&P is going through the roof, right? So you have to have some flexibility in your approach. So I wanted to start a group that at the core would use those quantitative metrics, but pure quantitative takes out kind of the fundamentals of investing, because a certain portion of a stock's return comes from what's going on at the company level. And the other thing is, if all I did was focus on the quantitative, you'd end up owning 300 securities.
So let's talk about it.
An SMA can't do that, or you don't drive enough active share.
SMA is separately managed account. Let's talk about active share. Because your portfolios are fairly concentrated. The U.S. core portfolio is 30 to 60 companies. That's considered a modest holding, a concentrated holding. Tell us about the thinking behind that concentration.
So it's funny, going back to that first job at Brown Brothers, you know, at the time in the 80s, no one knew about passive investing, but I observed that, you know, they'd have these portfolios and they'd have kind of two or three stocks in every sector. So you'd end up with, you know, 100 or 150 stocks. And, you know, not that they did poorly, but they never really, you know, it was really hard to drive a lot of active, you know, performance.
Everything is 1%, 2%.
And at the time, there wasn't really passive investing. But then as time progressed, all these studies came out and said, well, actually, the most excess return in active management comes from managers that are very, very active. Right. And if you own 100, 150 stocks and you're the benchmark is the S&P, you're not active. So it was clear to me that we needed very concentrated portfolios, but control the risk. And so that's why we run these limited portfolios. The applied term is so it gave some quantitative approach to what we do. But here's the practical, Barry, which is when the firm came to me and said, okay, you're going to become an asset management arm. You got to come up with a name for your team. I knew that these firms show asset management companies alphabetically.
So applied investing.
Right, I wasn't going to be Z applied.
Right.
I wanted to be at the top of the list.
That's AAA Exterminator. It's always the first one to call in the phone book. So let's talk about two things you just mentioned. One is active share. Mm-hmm. But really what you're implying are that a lot of these other funds with 200, 300 or more holdings, they're all high fee closet indexers. What's the value there?
Right. And that's why as an active manager, I have nothing against ETFs. I think it's done great for the industry, because shame on funds that own lots and lots of securities. You're not doing a service to your investing. But at the end of the day, if I marginally underperform, not me, but in general, you know, it will take time to lose your assets. You know, what's right for the money management firm is not always what's right for the investor. So the right thing is choose passive strategies, but there's a place for active management, but it's got to be active.
Core and satellite.
Exactly.
You have a core of a passive index, but you're surrounding it with something that gives you a little opportunity for more upside.
Exactly.
Huh, really, really interesting. So if the U.S. holdings are 30 to 60 companies, the global portfolio is even more concentrated, about 20 companies.
Yeah, I mean, so taking a step back again, Remember, I run mutual funds, but I started in the separate managed account business. So what it means is wealth management would implement our portfolio for individuals by buying stocks. And one of the things that I observed is that clients pull from the market faster than they pull from stocks. So in other words, when you're worried about the market, if it's about the market, some macro story, well, do you want to sell your Microsoft? Oh, no, I like Microsoft, but I'm worried about the market. Okay, well, owning individual securities is really powerful because it actually keeps people invested.
There's a brand name there that they relate to.
Exactly. So people are more likely to pull from the market. So I believe in owning stocks. But the problem is, again, it goes back to, but if you own 200 stocks, then they don't have any wedded. So could we start a strategy? We started this 08, where all the securities would be on one page.
That's amazing. So your global portfolio also has some international U.S. companies.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to things like LVMH and some other international stocks, you have Microsoft, you have Costco.
Correct.
What's the thinking of putting those giant U.S. companies in a global portfolio?
It goes back to, Barry, that concept, which is clients don't care, really, where they make their money.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with the benefit of a global strategy is I can own some U.S. stocks. In an international only, I can't own. And what happens if the U.S. just so happens to do better than the rest of the world? Then international doesn't work as well. So it just gives us more flexibility to go where the opportunity set is.
And to that point, your fund, the Morgan Stanley Institutional Global Concentrated Fund, which does have U.S. stock, trounced the MSCI ex-US because the U.S. has been outperforming international. That's another style since the financial crisis. The U.S. has been crushing everyone else.
But think about it this way also. If I can own 20 stocks, okay, but they're not all correlated to each other. So they have a lot of different themes. Like I really like this the infrastructure stocks right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think there's a place, as you said, Microsoft. But luxury brands, only a few stocks, but have a different theme, then I can control the risk in the portfolio.
You're diversified, so high active share, but concentrated.
High active share, but lower kind of risk.
So when I look at the Morgan Stanley Institutional U.S. Core, the description is we seek to outperform the benchmark regardless of which investment style, value or growth, is currently in favor. So you're style agnostic. You want to just stay with what's working.
Exactly. And Philip Kim is the other portfolio manager. We've worked together 14 years. I started these quantitative models, and then he really took it to the next level. And this was what has the likelihood of outperforming for the next 12 to 18 months from a style standpoint. That's how we bias the portfolio. Things could get just too expensive. Things get too cheap, but we need to see some migration in the opposite direction, and then we bias accordingly. We want to stay in the game.
What about the Russell 3000 strategy? That's not, it's obviously more concentrated than the Russell, but it's still a few hundred stocks. Tell us what goes into that thing.
Well, we noticed that our quantitative factor model alone was doing well, right? Beyond just adding the stock to buy. So we wanted to start a strategy that would add a little bit of excess return versus just buying an ETF that was just focused on that factor models, but we would diversify away the stock risk.
Really intriguing. So let's talk a little bit about Sliman's take, which is not only widely read at Morgan Stanley, it's also pretty widely distributed on the street itself. Towards the end of 2023, you put out a piece, a few lessons from the year, and I thought some of these were really fascinating, starting with the S&P 500 has produced a positive return in 67 of the past 93 years. The market produced two consecutive down years, only 11 times? That's amazing. I had no idea.
Well, I mean, think about it. The likelihood over time in any one year, the market's going to go up. And if it doesn't go up, that's irregular. But then to have another year in a row is very, very irregular. So that's why I began 2023 saying, hey, it's highly likely it's going to be a good year, just purely based on the odds. And then you layer in that whole recency bias rearview mirror, and people were way too negative.
Yeah, at the end of 2022, the S&P peak to trough was down about 25%. You point out there are only 8 instances since 1960 where you had that level of drawdown, and the average one-year return was 22% following that.
So I put out a piece in September of 2022 saying, market's down 20%. You should add money down 20%. And of course, I felt like an idiot, you know, a month later, because then the market was down 25%. And I produce a piece saying the average return is just over 20% if you buy into down 25%, which doesn't necessarily mean it stops going down.
Right.
But what's amazing about that is, you know what the return off that October 22nd low of 2022 was?
30-something?
No, 21%.
Oh, really? Dead on.
Right, dead on in line. It's uncanny how these things repeat itself. And that's, Barry, again, it goes back to, you know, your experience, my experiences. The macro changes, but behaviors don't.
Right.
That's the consistency of this business, and that's what I'm fascinated with.
Human nature is perpetual.
It is what it is,
No doubt about it.
And that's what gave me confidence that the fund flows would turn positive at some point in the fourth quarter, because it was a year off the low.
I really like that. Be dubious when a stock is declared expensive or cheap based on a singular valuation methodology like PE. This is a pet peeve of mine. The E is an estimate. It's someone's opinion. How can you rely on something, especially from someone who doesn't have a great track record of making these forecasts?
I think that's the biggest error investors make over time is, well, this stock is, you know, as you said, this stock is cheap, or this market. Think about Europe. Europe has looked cheaper than the U.S. for a number of years. The flaw in that is the E is a forward estimate, and it's turned out that the E for Europe hasn't been as good as what's expected, and the E for the U.S., especially the NASDAQ, has been a lot higher than was expected. So the denominator has come up in the U.S., which made the PE lower, and the denominator has come down in Europe, which made it look more expensive.
That's always amazing, is if the estimates are wrong to the downside, well, then expensive stocks aren't that expensive, and vice versa.
Exactly.
If the estimates are too high, cheap stocks really ain't cheap.
Right. I watched that, but we also watched revisions. And I've learned also from being, you know, cynically in this business, companies don't always come clean right away and say, oh, our business is really bad. It's that they drip out the news.
Right.
Usually one bad quarter follows another bad quarter. I mean, it's very rare. So be careful of that. And analysts are slow to adjust their numbers. Anytime someone says, I'm cutting my estimates, cutting my price target, but I think it's bottomed. Yeah, be careful.
That's always amusing. I thought this was really very perceptive. Over 37 years in the investment business, I have become convinced that the most money is made when perceptions move from very bad to less bad. I love that, because if you've lived through the dot-com implosion or the financial crisis or even the first quarter of 2020, you know how true that is.
Think about last year. You know, it's the old saying by Sir John Templeton, bull markets are born on pessimism, they grow in skepticism, they mature on optimism, and they die on euphoria. Well, we had a bear market bottom in October of 2022. And so we came into last year, 2023, with it's going to be a hard landing, it's going to be bad. And so there's high levels of pessimism. And now as you advance into the fourth quarter, fund flows turn positive as people realize, well, maybe it wasn't going to be so bad. We've moved into the skepticism phase. So that's why the biggest return year is always the first year off the low, because that's the biggest pivot and has the least volatility. We didn't have a lot of volatility last year.
And we saw that in 08-09, and we saw that in 2020. It was really quite amazing. The flip side of this is also true, which is most money is lost when things move from great to just good.
Well, again, if I go back to kind of growth investing, it got expensive and the growth rates of companies weren't quite as good. And, you know, in 2022, and the Fed started raising rates, and that was problematic. It was no different. It reminded me a little bit of the dot-com bubble. What brought down the dot-com bubble is that companies just couldn't report the earnings that were expected. And you had plenty of time to get out. But the problem is what I saw in the dot-com bubble, people wanted to keep buying these stocks as they're going lower because they were, you know, rear view mirror investing. They were the previous loves. And what's amazing is, think about it, I said before, half the value managers went out of business in 99. By the year 2008, do you know what the biggest sector of the S&P was? Financials. They grew from nothing to 30% of the S&P. So value worked all through the first period until we know what happened in the Great Financial Crisis.
It's amazing that muscle memory, when you're rewarded for buying the dip for a decade, it's a tough habit to break.
Exactly.
So here's another really interesting observation of yours. Whatever the hot product is, rarely works the next 12 months.
It's because a hot product invariably pushes, oftentimes, valuations to extreme. And one of the things that we got very right in 2023 was, in 2022 bear market, what did people buy into the lows of bear market? They bought defensive stocks, dividend-oriented, low volatility type strategies became very popular in 2022 during a bear market. And so we could see that the defensive factor, safety, became very expensive. So as we came out of this bear market, what lagged? Consumer staples, healthcare, utilities, all the safe things. So hot products pushes things to extreme, and that usually, you know, unwinds itself badly.
Historically, once the Fed stops hiking rates, equity rallies last longer and go higher than anyone expects. Explain the thinking there.
So I think it's good news for this year, but also worries me about this year, is if you look at the history of the period of time when the Fed said we're done hiking till we're going to cut, that period does very, very well for equities. And we're kind of at a juncture where we've done pretty well, but if they're not going to cut rates until the summer, I think there's more room to run for stocks. Now, the flip side is, I hear a lot of people talk about when the Fed cuts, the perception that that's going to be good for equities. I'm not so sure about that. Because if you look back in history, when the Fed cuts, markets tend to go down initially, not up. And you could argue, yes, but Andrew, that's because usually when they're raising rates, it's an economic cycle.
Right.
And therefore, if they're cutting, there's a problem. And this time it was all about inflation. But what worries me is when the Fed does announce they'll cut, will people say, oh, they know something you don't know. There's a problem out there. And I think that will increase the anxiety. And so I think we're in a good period right now, but it worries me when they do cut, will it be people start to worry about there's a problem in the economy.
See, I'm a student of Federal Reserve history, and I could say with a high degree of confidence, they don't know anything that you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
They look at the same data. They're populated by humans, none of whom have demonstrated any particular mm-hmm. sort of prescience. And if we watched the past decade, they were late to get off their emergency footing. They were late to recognize inflation. They were late to recognize inflation peaked, and now it feels like they're late to recognize, hey, you guys won. You beat inflation.
Yeah, exactly.
Take a victory lap.
Right.
They seem to always be, talk about backwards looking, they always seem to be behind the curve.
Right. But I just think the stock market is an emotional beast.
Sure.
And I look last year and the bears, people were too pessimistic. Every time they popped their head out of the den, they got stampeded. And so they'll have a better year this year, and I think it will scare investors. And cynically, I can't help but think, well, a lot of people missed last year, and now they're starting to get back in. And after a very low volatility year, there's always more volatility the next year. And so it's inevitable it's going to be more. It doesn't mean it'll be a bad year for equities. It just will have more gut-wrenching periods.
I love this data point. Since 1940, markets have always gone up in the year when an incumbent president runs for re-election. 17 for 17. Now, if we break that down, what you're really saying is, hey, if an incumbent isn't running, the economy really has to be in the stinkeroo and the stock market is following. But anytime an incumbent is running typically means we're doing pretty okay.
Well, and remember, I said didn't get reelected, just ran for reelection, right? And so what happens, and I see it this year, is when presidents run for reelection, they want to juice the economy. They want the economy going well.
Right.
And we have, Joe Biden has in his pocket the Infrastructure Act, the CHIPS Act, and the Inflation Reduction Act. We own, the reason why we own industrial stocks is because they are telling us that the money is just starting to come in from the government. And these projects are getting off the way. We've seen this with the CHIPS Act. The money has just started pouring.
Right.
That's why the market tends to do well, because the economy stays afloat during a reelection year.
And the really interesting thing about all this, you know, it's funny, the 2020s is the decade of fiscal stimulus, whereas the 2010s mm-hmm. were monetary stimulus. The first three CARES Acts, that was just a boatload of money that hit the market, hit the economy all at once. Each of the legislation packages you mentioned, that's spending over a decade. That could be a pretty decent tailwind for a while.
Very interesting between listening to Wall Street and what you listen to companies. And so I'm a company guy. I listen to companies. And I'll give you a great example right now. People think the consumer is getting tapped out. But on the Costco call the other day, they say they see big ticket purchase items reaccelerating. Well, wait a minute. I thought the consumer.
Well, which is it?
Which is it, right? And you know, and so the point of this is that I go back to listen to what companies say, and I suspect as food inflation starts to come down and people have jobs, they actually could start to go buy, you know, higher ticket purchases.
And so, we've seen some uptick in credit card use, but nothing problematic. With the ability to service that debt still seems to be very much intact.
Correct. And that goes back to last year. The other reason I was optimistic is I kept hearing our companies say to me, I'm being told a recession's around the corner, but our business seems to be doing well.
We don't see it. Right.
We don't see it.
That's really amazing.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
So let's talk a little bit about who your clients are. You obviously are working with all the advisors at Morgan Stanley, but you're managing mutual funds. Who are
sure.
the buyers of those funds? Are they in-house? Are they the rest of the investing community? Who are your clients?
Yeah, I mean, so that's when I left being advisor in 2004. I started this group within Morgan Stanley Wealth Management. The products were only available to financial advisors at Morgan Stanley. But when I left to go into Morgan Stanley Investment Management in 2014, the purpose of that was to make my products available beyond Morgan Stanley Wealth Management, because I was getting calls from consultants and institutional investors saying, how do we get access to these funds? And I'd have to say, well, you have to go through an advisor. So that I wanted to broaden out the reach beyond. So I would say we're on a number of platforms. You can buy our funds through the self-directed route. And so we're broadening out the distribution. And you mentioned the slim intake before, that is a methodology that we use to reach out to our investor base. Obviously, I'd love to talk to each of every one of them, but I can't. But I've learned in this business, if you communicate in a way that they can understand, and I don't mean understand in a, you know, in a bad way, like, but writing a 6-page diatribe about why my stocks are so great and why the rest of the market stinks, no one's going to read that. They put it aside and say, I'll read it tonight, then they don't. But if you can provide short bullets of what's going on in the market, why people should be bullish or bearish, you provide them with talking points. And that's what we really try to do within the firm, but beyond the firm as well.
Yeah, I one of the reasons I like Sliman's take is you really boil things down to brass tacks. You're not afraid to use third parties in some of your competitors' research. You cite other people on the street when they have an interesting data point or I very much appreciate that because a lot of people sort of take the if it wasn't invented here, it doesn't exist to us.
Yeah, I mean, look, I want to grow the assets. I want to perform well, but I value the responses from those who sit on the front lines dealing with clients every day because they're the ones that feel kind of the emotional side of the
sure.
business. If you sit back in, you know, my office and all I'm looking at a company and just evaluating whether its PE is appropriate in earnings, you're missing a huge part of this business. It's a behavioral business. And so having access to advisors and listening to their feedback is so important.
So you serve on Morgan Stanley's Wealth Management's Global Investment Committee. What is that experience like? I would imagine that's a huge amount of capital and a tremendous responsibility.
It is a huge amount of capital, and it drives kind of suggested asset allocation for advisors. They don't necessarily have to pursue it that way. My input is obviously on the equity side, but they have people in the fixed income, high yield, alternatives, and they all provide inputs into framing an overview. So I sit in Morgan Stanley Investment Management, but I do provide that context, and I think they like to have me on because I actually have skin in the game and I run money for a living. And I'm not always there saying you got to buy growth, or you got to buy value. So I'm agnostic. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to figure out where the ball is going.
So in the old days, you used to speak with retail investors all the time. As a PM, do you miss that back and forth? Because there is some signal in all of that noise, whether it's fear or greed or
sure.
emotion. How do you operate being arm's length away from that?
That is a big concern I have, is losing that access. So I'm speaking at an event tonight with a room full of advisors. So, and then, you know, we'll get together afterwards and I'll listen to what they have to say. So I'm always interested in feedback that I get from advisors. Obviously, I can't spend all day talking on the phone. That's the big reason why I left being an advisor, was I recognize, hey, being an advisor, you got to talk to your clients, so forth. You can't manage money and worry
can't
about
do
quarter.
Both.
You can't do both. And anyone that thinks you can, it's crazy. And I really want to develop these models. But so all these communication ways, like Slim and Take, is a way to be in touch with advisors, encourage them. Hey, you think you disagree? Send me an email. You know, I'm happy to hear from you because I think that's very important.
I'm
behavioral finance. You know, the longer I've been in this business, I've been in this business a long time. It's the behavioral finance. That's the consistency of this business. Geopolitics changes, right? But how people react is not
right.
Doesn't really change.
You can't control what country is invading what other country, but you can manage your own behavior. And,
exactly.
and people have a hard time with that.
Exactly.
It's really interesting. I know I only have you for another 5 minutes, so let me jump to my favorite questions. I ask all of my guests, starting with, what have you been streaming these days? Tell us what's been, either audio or video, what's been keeping you entertained?
Yeah, so if I think about my career, no one took me aside and said, this is how you manage money, right? Like, think about it. I learned about fundamental research. I learned about quantitative. I learned about the practicality of being in wealth management. And so I've always researched and watched. And what does that have to do with your question is I've learned my way to being successful portfolio mm-hmm. manager. So I'm obsessed with kind of always learning along the way. So, you know, when I watch podcasts, it's all about, or listen to podcasts or watch, you know, things. It's all how to advance my knowledge base. Now, I did play tennis, you know, in college. Mm-hmm. And so I love all those, you know, break point, first tee, you know, the Formula One. I love all those things. But you know, as my wife gets frustrated with me because I'm probably not going to sit down and watch a three-hour mindless movie because it's kind of like not advancing.
Really, really interesting. Tell us about your mentors who helped to shape your career.
So, I mean, again, I look at points along the way were invaluable. When I got to Morgan Stanley, Byron Wien, who, you know, I barely knew, but he was the first person that I recognized had this very good touch of fundamentals, but also the psychology. And so he was a great mentor, even though he never really knew me, but listening and reading and understanding him was really important. But then I had a guy who ran our department named Glenn Regan, who had come from studying money management organizations. And I didn't know how to start a money management organization because it was a team within, and how do you grow and diversify? So there's been different people along the way that have really shaped me. I came out of University of Chicago. Gene Fama told me buy cheap stocks, but then William O'Neill said, yeah, but that doesn't work. And you need to have some momentum to, you know, like he didn't tell me that.
You need a little can slim in
you need that. You know, you had a little can slim. So you need can slim. Exactly. So there's been people along the way that have been great influences on me that have mentored me at the right time in my career.
What are some of your favorite books and what are you reading right now?
I just finished Same as Ever by Morgan Housel. Again, this concept of behavioral, I will eat up. You put a behavioral, anything about behaviors in front of me, I read it. So like, you know, Richard Thaler, Misbehaving, or, you know, Think Fast, Think Slow. All those books of books. Daniel Crosby is another one. All those books, I just finished that. And I just love it because, again, all he spends, the whole book is about these things, they just don't change over time.
Human nature.
Human, perpetual. Human nature.
Really interesting.
I'll tell you the last story. I was on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange the day that Russia invaded Crimea. Mm-hmm. And one of my stocks was down, my biggest position was down 8% that day. And I said, they don't have any stores in Crimea. Why is the stock down? Well, because it was geopolitics. Well, you know, and within 3 days, the stock came roaring back. So it's all it points to is sometimes fundamentals dislodge from, you know, the stock prices. And you have to understand that there's a behavioral element.
My favorite version of that story was, are you familiar with Cuba?
Yeah, sure.
So Obama announces we're going to normalize or start the process of normalizing relationships with Cuba. There's a stock that trades under the symbol CUBA, having nothing whatsoever, yes, yeah. And it runs up 20% on the announcement.
Correct.
Because some algorithm picked up Cuba and bought it, and off we go.
Correct.
Amazing. All right, our final two questions. What sort of advice would you give to a recent college grad interested in a career in either investment management or finance?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I have four kids that are, you know, in the process of, or have just come out of college or in the process of it. And one of the dangers I see today is kids come out of school and they think they know exactly what they want to do. You know, and I'll say, you don't know what your capabilities are when you're 22 years old. I mean, I was an introvert when I was 22. I've realized in the early 30s, I knew how to communicate. So I all say, if you can get into a firm that has a lot of opportunities. You know, today there's less training programs, but those types of things with lots of opportunities, because you don't know what you're going to be good at. And what you're good at, always follow what you think you're interested in, as long as it makes money, because that's ultimately, but you don't know initially. So I always encourage people initially, don't come out and say, I want to do this the rest of my life. You don't know. That's too narrow. Try to go to something broad. That's the first advice. And I see today where people too narrow in their focus.
I think that's great advice. People, most of the folks I work with who are very successful, they're not doing what they did right out of school. And to imagine that that's going to be your career, very much misleading. And our final question, what do you know about the world of investing today that you wish you knew 30 plus years ago when you were first getting started?
Well, I think, you know, 30 years ago, I thought it was all about just what's going on at the company level. And then I realized, oh, wait, that doesn't really, you know, drive most of a stock's return. So you have to understand more about the broader implications of companies. I think 30 years ago, there was less dissemination of fundamental news broadly. Today, it's much, you know, it's much broader. So having information access fundamentally is more difficult. So I think the business has changed. But again, I go back to, I think the biggest change in how I think about it is behaviorally. I've come to the realization that being an advisor, sitting on the front line, I view that as a very key part of what's shaped my career, understanding that, you know, again, it doesn't matter that the company didn't have any stores in Crimea. It went down for, you know, quite a bit. Or your Cuba story. I mean, that there's just a behavioral element to this investing business. And look, you know, again, I go a great example, which I mentioned before, which is it didn't matter what growth stocks you owned in 2022. They all went down. Right. And so was it all the companies did poorly? No, growth got too overbought. And so it had a correction. They all came back last year, you know. So understanding kind of those behaviors, I love that Warren Buffett quote, investors frame their view looking solidly in the rearview mirror, understanding that and having the ability to tack against that. That's really what's worked for me over time.
Really fascinating stuff. Thank you, Andrew, for being so generous with your time. We have been speaking with Andrew Slimmon. He's Managing Director at Morgan Stanley Investment Management, where he is also Lead Portfolio Manager for the Long Equity Strategies for the Applied Equity Advisors team. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and check out any of the 500 previous discussions we've done over the past 9.5 years. You can find those at iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you find your favorite podcast. Sign up for my daily reading list at ritholtz.com. Follow me on Twitter at ritholtz. Follow all of the Bloomberg family of podcasts on Twitter at podcast. And be sure to check out my new podcast, At the Money, short 10-minute conversations with experts about the most important topics affecting you and your money. At the Money can be found at the Masters in Business podcast feed. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack team that helps put these conversations together each week. Meredith Frank is my audio engineer. Atika Valbron is my project manager. Sean Russo is my head of research. Anna Luke is my producer. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, let's face it, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. There's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.